They say you can't put a price on happiness, but it turns out you actually can. Quite an exact price, in fact. New research has identified the exact income level needed for Australians to reach peak happiness. And we'll be telling you about what that income level is in just a moment. But how much of a role do you think money or income plays in your happiness? And how much do you think you need to earn a happy life? You can leave a comment on the ABC Radio National Facebook page. Dr. Richard Morris is a cognitive scientist with the University of Sydney. He's one of the researchers behind this new study. It's called, quite poignantly, The Increasing Cost of Happiness. And Richard, hello. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for having me. Fantastic to be here.
Oh, it's good. I'm glad. Does that mean you're feeling happy at the moment?
I am. I'm very happy.
Oh, good to hear. Richard, you've compiled Australian data on this research on the back of the original US research. Do you want to take us back to what was discovered in the United States and then we'll move into the local scene?
Sure. So back in 2010, a professor of psychology called Daniel Kahneman, who's very famous for writing books about thinking fast and thinking slow. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics, but one of the things he published in 2010 was the idea that in the US, happiness levels, average happiness levels, increased with income up to a point, but at a certain point, average happiness levels stopped increasing with income. And that point for Daniel Kahneman was about $75,000 in the US at that time. And that was interesting because at the same time in the US, the median income, i.e. the average income earned by someone in the US was about $50,000. So that point was quite a lot higher than what most Americans were earning.
So there's a distinct gap there. And then if you apply the same rationales but in an Australian context, how did you draw on data for that?
So we used data from the Melbourne Institute. They've been collecting data on Australian households for 20 years, since 2001, and it's a fantastic data set. And it tracks about 11,000 Australians, and they survey them every year about everything, about their household, about how much they're earning, how happy they are, how satisfied they are with their life, as well as a bunch of other stuff. And we were interested in, well, if the change point that Daniel Kahneman identified was about $75,000 in the US, what is it in Australia? So we looked at every year from 2001 to 2019 in Australia. And what we found is that early on, at the early start of the millennium, that change point was about $43,000, which was much closer to the median income in Australia at the time. But in the last 20 years, that change point's increased to $74,000, and that is now much higher than the median income in Australia.
So what is the current median income in Australia?
So Australia's median income has bounced around $50,000 per household for about the last 10 years. It hasn't shifted a lot. It was increasing before 2010, but after 2010, it stopped increasing. And we think
that would accord, Richard, with the numerous reports over numerous years of wage stagnation in this country.
Well, that's exactly right. So what we're seeing is stagnating incomes. And at the same time, if we just look at the average happiness level, regardless of income, we can see that happiness levels started to decline in Australia year on year after about 2010. And that to us was a concerning puzzle.
Yes, and now you've put that premise forward, I have to ask you, do you have any solutions to that puzzle? Why is our happiness levels declining in those 10 years?
Yeah, so the work that we've recently published was purely descriptive. We weren't trying to figure out why things were happening. We were just wondering, you know, is there a change at which happiness is no longer affected by income.
Right.
But it's led us to think or to speculate that there's lots of reasons why people might be less happy in the last 10 years. If we consider things like changes in modern life, increased demands, increased financial pressures in modern life, in combination with a stagnating income, it probably isn't too surprising when you think about those issues, that more and more people are reporting declining happiness levels.
Richard, would it also go to some way of explaining this by looking at the measurement of inequality in Australian society?
Yeah, well, we found that really interesting. So a lot of economists and government departments focus on income inequality, and they'll report statistics like the Gini index. I don't know if your listeners have heard of that.
Sounds like something from Star Wars, but go ahead.
It's just a standard economic index of how much inequality exists over the income range. And so if you've got a lot of rich people and a lot of poor people, no one in between, you'll have a very high Gini index. So a high Gini index isn't good. Australia's Gini index, its income inequality has been fairly stable and also pretty much bang on the OECD average. So generally Australia, when you look at Australia's economic indicators, things like income inequality, things like life satisfaction, even household income, they've either been stable or increasing. And so what our findings are really pulling out is that there's this underlying change that's occurring that's being missed by all these standard indicators.
And so 74,000, which, just coming back to dollar terms, 74,000, you say, now is where peak happiness occurs in Australians' lives. This is where they have enough money to feel comfortable, and any more income than that doesn't change or increase their level of happiness. So there must be something else going on here.
Yeah, well, that's right. So the $74,000 is just saying that at that point, on average, Australians who have more than that money are not happier because of their income. They might be. You can still get happier if you earn more, even if you earn less. You can still be happy because, you know, you spend time with friends, or you have a good family life, or you're pleased with your job and things like that. Those things all still impact your happiness. But this is really just saying, after that point of income, improving your income after that is unlikely to improve your happiness a great deal. It's not likely to change it.
Well, just before we pull all this apart a bit more, Richard, I just want to also pinpoint something else you found that's kind of alarming, and that is the number of people in this country who now have the ability to reach 74,000.
Yes. So we've seen that number is obviously declined. In 2001, approximately 50% or just under 60% of people could reach that point. So that left a good chunk of our population whose happiness didn't depend on their income. But by 2019, 74% of people are under that change point, or under the $74,000 income level. And so that means there's a really small proportion of Australians now who can say that they're financially secure enough that they don't care about their income, whereas for the vast majority of us, we're still feeling that pressure.
I've got to say, that's a little bit depressing, but let's dig deeper into what this means by bringing in our second guest for today on this. Dr. Lisa Williams is a social psychologist at the University of New South Wales, and she specialises in the study of happiness and life satisfaction. And Lisa, hello.
Hi.
Lisa, let me ask you first, are you surprised by Richard's findings in this research?
No, I'd say these findings are broadly consistent with a pattern that we see in the research on the relationship between income and well-being. Of course, the detail and the insight about the Australian context is new and really important for policymakers and the general public to understand kind of how their income might be contributing to their happiness.
I also feel, Lisa, that we need to define some terms here. What is the difference in your mind between measuring someone's happiness and their life satisfaction?
That's a really great question. So from a research perspective, we talk about happiness as an emotional state that might shift around moment to moment or day to day. So it tends to be a fairly flexible construct that you can measure in the moment. life satisfaction tends to be a bit more stable. It's the broad sense that your life is fulfilled, that there may not be very much you would change about your life. So those are quite different things. However, a lot of researchers talk about those two things synonymously at the same time to reflect what we call well-being. So there's a perspective that having happiness and having satisfaction with your life contribute to this sense of well-being.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because from the way you talk about it there, it seems to me that what you're saying is that happiness can be that short-term endorphin rush, if you like, but life satisfaction has a longer sort of longer term continuum where you measure whole, you know, various parts of your life against the whole and come up with a sense of, well, I feel better now than maybe I did 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's precisely right. So if you think about if I asked you right now how happy you are and I asked you this evening how happy you are, you could easily predict that those may not be the same thing. But if I asked you how satisfied you were with your life, you probably would answer pretty similarly this morning to this evening.
If you're listening to this conversation with Dr. Lisa Williams and Dr. Richard Morris, as we talk about not only the economic trigger for feeling happy, and at the moment, Richard's arrived with his team at a data point or an income point of about $74,000 as that peak happiness moment in our lives. And then we're talking also about life satisfaction here with Lisa. Tell us how you feel about this kind of stuff. Do you actually relate your own sense of life contentment, satisfaction on income, or are there other variables at play that you'd like to suggest to us? If you'd like to get involved in that, don't hesitate to leave a comment on the ABC Radio Facebook page. We've got a post up there about that. Lisa, can I just come back to you? Because one of the areas of research that I know you've undertaken that I find really intriguing is about the importance of meaning to life satisfaction and, if I may say, happiness. Just tell us a little bit about how meaning plays such a vital role in that.
Sure. So a moment ago, we were talking about happiness and life satisfaction. And if you put those on one side, we have another view of well-being that is, excuse me, to be well, you need more than just those instantaneous moments of happiness, and you need more than just a sense of satisfaction in your life. That more happens to be around ideas of meaning or purpose. So having a sense of contribution to the community, having a sense that your activities impact others, turns out to be pretty important. So one way to think about that is, what if you had happiness and life satisfaction, but without a sense of meaning or purpose? What research suggests is that's a pretty big gap. So if you pursue happiness at the expense of having meaning or purpose, that's not really an ideal state of being. But if we flip the cards, what research suggests is that people who pursue activities that give them meaning and purpose and contribution also end up experiencing more happiness, which is a really interesting relationship. And it suggests one way we can go about achieving happiness is actually not to pursue happiness itself, but rather to pursue activities that give us meaning and purpose.
At a very, very esoteric level, I would imagine Bill Gates at some stage in his life was dealing with exactly that kind of dilemma, because he was at one stage, I think, one of the richest people in the world, you know, multiple billionaire. And he and his partner set up the Gates Foundation, which is pouring all these, not all these riches, but quite a significant portion of those riches into solving the globe's health problems. And that would give his life meaning. Would you agree
right
with that, Lisa? Yeah.
Yes. So, excuse me. So I do think that that's an interesting perspective. And I think what you find is that individuals who have a great deal of income end up having a lot of disposable income that they can choose what to do with. And those individuals who choose to do that in a way that have meaning tend to achieve a higher sense of well-being overall.
Richard, coming back to you, did you actually measure for this term life satisfaction as well as happiness?
Yeah, one of the best things about the HILDA data set is that it has quite detailed measures on all these things. So has life satisfaction measured as a single question, just how generally satisfied are you with your life on a scale of 0 to 10? And then it has all the questions about how you've been feeling over the last month, which is how we get our happiness score.
Right.
And what we saw corresponds to what Lisa was just describing. And it's an issue that I think is really important, and I'm glad Lisa brought it up, is that this distinction that we see between life satisfaction and happiness in the results is quite clear. Life satisfaction for the last 20 years has been stable, and in Australia it's been higher, I think, than the OECD. So Australians are on the whole very satisfied. What's changing is their happiness, is their day-to-day feelings.
Oh, that's really intriguing. I find that, I would have thought there was a correlation in trend, but it's not. So in fact, even though you've discovered that there are decreasing rates of day-to-day happiness, overall, we're a fairly satisfied lot and have been for some time.
Exactly. More satisfied than many other countries in the OECD. So it's, and economists, rightly or wrongly, have focused on life satisfaction, and Lisa's right. A lot of researchers will refer to that as a happiness measure, but it's really not. It's measuring something quite different. This cognitive evaluation of your life: how satisfied are you with the goals you've achieved, with the house you live in, things like that.
And Richard, is there a correlation still between income up to $74,000 and life satisfaction?
There is, yes. So life satisfaction continues to increase with income. So it turns out when you ask people how satisfied they are with their life, presumably some of them are looking at the dollar value on their payslip and saying, yeah, I'm pretty satisfied.
Others not so much, though, given that we know there's a rising rate of inequality in this country. We've discussed that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it presents a problem. And all these changes occurred pre-COVID too. And so before COVID, Australia had just experienced, 30 odd years of uninterrupted economic growth. And yet for the last 10 of them, we weren't happier, though we were very satisfied. And COVID represents this huge disruption. The economic consequences we don't fully understand yet, and the consequences on people's well-being and their subjective well-being are yet to be determined. But it will be very interesting times.
It will be interesting times. I was going to say it surely has to be significant. And Lisa, when it comes to searching for meaning and purpose, surely the last 2 years have really put that into focus for so many Australians.
Yeah, I think as we see people unable to engage in their typical everyday activities, folks have turned to those that they can do that actually have a deeper connection to how they want to be spending their time. So investing in family, in engaging in community contributions. We have seen a shift in people's orientation about what they value in how they spend their time.
And relationships, clearly, where you sometimes just can't see a friend or a family member for literally months on end, really heightens your appreciation of the meaning and significance of those relationships in your life.
That's right. We've seen a great, so the initial research we're seeing out of the impact of COVID on well-being is that people are certainly experiencing more stress and less positive emotion. However, people who are able to design their activities so that they can connect with others, so for instance, via video calls during lockdown, they're actually still maintaining some positivity in the face of this huge global adverse event.
We have to wrap it up, you two, but I do want to ask you, Richard Morris, for some final thoughts on this. I know that at the moment you're collecting and observing data, and it will be fascinating to see what the pandemic years have done to people's attitude towards their lives. But if we want to see a reversal in that downturn in happiness so it correlates with our life satisfaction, any thoughts on how we could do that?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting problem. And as a cognitive scientist, I don't have any recommendations for government or individuals. But I would emphasise Lisa's point that she raised earlier, is that pursuing happiness is unlikely to achieve it. You know, and the same goes for the government or government policy. My research speaks to the kind of a bird's eye view of the nation. And so there the implications are, you know, what changes can we make to modern life, to our cities and how we live and structure our lives? Whether or not, you know, I think we need to track these measures, and I think we need to understand more about how our policies and our decisions affect these measures for the nation.
It sounds to me like community contribution is clearly in there. The act of giving gives us that sense of happiness and long-term life satisfaction. That's my take out from all this, but I do thank you both very much. It's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Richard Morris is a cognitive scientist with the University of Sydney, one of the researchers behind this new study, The Increasing Cost of Happiness. And also Dr. Lisa Williams, who's a social psychologist at the University of New South Wales, where she specialises in the study of happiness and life satisfaction. Gee, those terms are so loaded, aren't they?